Get ready to get your nerd on.
Kick the week off right with games, gadgets, and general geekery from the ladies of the Electric Sisterhood.
On Tuesdays, get your pop culture news and reviews with a pure Bostonian perspective on the Boston Bastard Brigade.
Geek Aggro is coming at you on Wednesdays to fill what's left of your cerebral cortex with the hottest beats to get you on your feet.
Then on Thursdays, you have me, Phil the Issues Guy, presenting the Live Issues program.
It's going down each week. Only in the land of Ash, nerdcore at its finest.
Hey guys, this is King Baby Duck here, and the other day I came across an article online on Nerdy But Flirty by Jessica Crosby entitled Autism, Gaming, and Me, How Video Games Helped. It showcased how Crosby went from someone that was spastic and antisocial due to the disability to someone who is now in control of everything and has a strong and active social life. As someone who can relate to her struggles, you know, as someone who's autistic, I figured I would sit down with Mrs. Crosby and chat with her about the article, as well as our thoughts and opinions on how autism is portrayed in the media, plus how we grew up with it. And here's how it went. Thank you so much for coming on to this edition of 101 on Boston Bash Brigade.
You're welcome. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. So, first of all, what made you want to write this article in the first place?
Well, I was having a really hard time accepting myself as I was. And so I got the idea of writing it to kind of walk myself through the process of accepting who I am and the way that I am. And I was trying to find my own inner strength while helping other autistic women or children or anybody with autism accept themselves as well.
That's really good. And I've shown this article to a couple other people. I've shown it to even some of my family members who know what I've gone through in life, and they think you did a fantastic job nailing it right on the head.
I like your family.
Thank you. So when did you first become aware of your autism spectrum?
Okay, so I was 17, actually, the first time that the possibility of being autistic ever came up to me. I found myself in a hospital for about 2 weeks. I just had an extreme lack of control. I was really having trouble communicating more than I had ever had in my entire life, and I was really just going downhill with being, afraid of leaving the house, talking to people, really extreme obsessive-compulsiveness, and so I ended up being in the hospital, and they started talking about, let's test you for autism. And then there was a lot of back and forwardness for a lot of years about, what it could be, how to treat it. And there was, like I said, a lot of going back and forth. And then I was 23, actually, when my doctor was like, well, let's send you to a geneticist. And then from there, they started giving me, more of an in-depth, you're this form, you're that form, let's test you for this, let's test you for that. And then it came out, Asperger's and Rett syndrome. And then Rett's was defined after they were battling, well, is it Turner's, is it Rett's? And they settled on Turner's, so I was 23.
Wow. I'm actually quite shocked at that because, I hear that it's a lot difficult to really treat it if you catch it at a much later age.
Yeah, I could have benefited a lot in my childhood growing up if I had the fortunate capability of being able to go to doctors and talking about and working through things. But I guess I wasn't what people perceived autism to be, because I was functioning. I was talking, I was doing things on my own, which, normally stereotypically people don't think in an autistic person. So with my family not being very well aware of what an autistic child could be, the possibility just never came up to them about, well, let's go get her tested. The thought was never there.
All right, because I want to say my parents were first concerned when I was 2.5, when they saw that my behavior wasn't as normal as, the other kids that were around me, other families with kids and such. And it was, right around that time when they first diagnosed me. So I was sent to, this place called the Mace Center, which is a school for, autistic and Asperger's kids and such. And For me, I wasn't fully aware that I had the disability until I was 9 years old, and I just started noticing more and more books about autism in my parents' room. So one day I just questioned it. It was like, why do you have all this here? And they sat me down and they just basically explained to me what it was that I had. And I was actually quite shocked because it really never hit me until right then and there that I was different from anybody else.
Oh. So how did you accept it? Like, how long did it take for you to be like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. Or, I mean, what was it like for you learning it? Other than
it was, you know, when you're 9 years old, you're still pretty young. So it took me, I want to say a few months to really fully accept it, because I remember I was so upset the next day in school. I was crying about it, and people were, and even my fellow students and friends was like, what's wrong? And then I told them, and they were like, they were kind of shocked about it as well. So about a week later, my mom came in and to the third, I believe it was the third grade, and had all the students listen in to her and tell people what it was that I had, and just accept me for who I was the same way they did before they found out.
That's cool. I love that your family was so open about it when you asked.
Yeah, I was very happy about it. I was a smart kid growing up, so, like, if they had, there was no way they could have, like, you know, try to bypass it from me.
You wake up one day and you're like, why didn't you ever tell me? Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting because for you, you said it wasn't until you were 23 until you were officially diagnosed of it.
Yeah.
And it brings me to mind, I don't know if you ever remember a band called The Vines.
I've heard of them, yes.
Well, their lead singer, Craig Nichols, or lead singer guitarist, was diagnosed with Asperger's at the age of, like, 29, because he had been having a lot of issues with, like, freaking out on stage and at audience members, and not in the rock star sense that most rock stars do, but like, flipping out scary type of things happening. So come to find out, it was being affected because of all the fast food he was eating, all the pot he was smoking, and...
Oh. Okay, well...
So that wound up, like, affecting him unknowingly because he didn't know he had Asperger's at the time.
Okay.
So once he did find out, he had to, you know, cut down from everything. He had to cut down... He stopped eating fast food. He had to give up the weed and all that. So it was really interesting to see someone who was that late into development find out that they were disabled.
I mean, I guess and people are used to getting their diagnoses when they're younger, but I don't know. I wish I had known when I was younger, but I'm not sure. I'm totally forget where I was going with this. Sorry.
It's okay. Don't worry. Let's talk a little bit about the article, because it does focus primarily on how video games helped you overcome your disability.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember when I was 7, about a year or two before I knew about my disability, when I bought my first system. It was one of those 20-pound Game Boys, the first ones that came out with Tetris and Bart Simpson Escapes from Camp Deadly. do you remember at all the first video game that you yourself bought?
That I myself bought with my allowance or with my work money?
Probably with your allowance. I mean, I'm okay. Talking about your first game in general.
First game. So it would have to be on the Game Boy, the original Game Boy with Zelda. I don't remember which story of Zelda it was, but it was Zelda. And I remember begging and begging and begging for weeks to have my parents buy that game for me. And they're like, well, I guess we can start giving you allowance. So I saved up my allowance for a very long time and bought it. And I remember wearing out the pads on that Game Boy to the point that, like, I just couldn't play the Game Boy anymore.
Wow.
All I wanted to play was Zelda.
Yeah, about a bit of the same story with me saving up for a Game Boy. They finally gave me an allowance, and I like saved up like a dollar a week for almost 2 years to buy one.
Yeah, I remember that. And actually, my brother, my older brother, had a Game Boy before I did. So as soon as I got the game, I had kind of taken it from him and kind of absconded with it, which was fine because at that point, he was 3 years older than me. So by that point in time, you know, he'd been moved on into like middle school and, you know, worried about other things other than gaming. So
in this article, you did speak a lot about Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
So what was it about this game that not only drew you in, but really helped you like figure out about your disability?
Okay, so I've never been very good with like speaking to people or fitting in, you know, social environments or making friends. Like, I've always had a really hard time with that. And so Final Fantasy was the first game that I played where you had companions that you really got to know. And, because I had never played the Final Fantasy series before then. Like, I just played like Duck Hunters and like Sonic the Hedgehog and, you know, games like that. So it was a new type of gaming for me, and there was so much to get invested in, and it was the first time that I had really just been completely drawn into a game, and I found that I really loved it. Like, my parents kept telling me, you gotta stop, you gotta go practice the violin, you gotta do your homework, you need to do your chores, and I was like, no, Final Fantasy VII! I don't remember what it was about it initially, but I do remember that I started playing because I wanted to play Aerith. Like, I started building up on my characters, and I got so invested in it. And yeah, I found my family kept telling me that I needed to stop doing this because I kept telling everybody that I wanted to be a flower girl, and they're like, "Well, you can't be a flower girl." And it's like, but Aerith is a flower girl, and you know, just stupid stuff like that. Yeah. So I started acting like the characters in the game, and I don't think that I did this on purpose. It was just kind of happening, and, like, I'd be at school, and I would just be, like, so focused on the game and thinking about the game, and, what would Aerith do? What would Cloud say? You know, would Barret kick this person's ass? You know, and I started using that to just kind of get myself through situations that before I wouldn't have been able to speak up in or say anything about, and I was standing up for myself, and, I mean, it took a long time for me to realize that it was because of games and that I was learning from it, but I do owe Final Fantasy VII, you know, the congratulations and the appreciation of getting me to a point where I could actually focus on something. So they were my, I know this sounds really dumb, but they were my friends. Like, it wasn't a video game to me. Like, they were my friends. They were my people. And I was, for the first time that I can remember, really invested in something, and it was a great feeling.
Mm. And I could kind of relate to that for a couple reasons, because I remember as a kid, like, growing up in video games, the one game that I really was just face deep into was the whole Sonic the Hedgehog franchise, the old Sega Genesis franchise. And it was to the point where, like when I was playing outside, I would you know, have them as, like, my imaginary friends of sorts, like Sonic and Tails and Knuckles and, you know, pretending to beat up Dr. Robotnik and even the cartoon villains of, like, Scratch and Grounder and Coconuts and all those. It would be me, like, doing all this in my backyard by myself, but then going back to school and then just talking, just thinking of what I was doing back in my backyard and then putting that towards me talking with my other friends and such about, you know, video games and just about basic life stuff. Because there, as a kid, you know, I really wasn't allowed to watch, you know, MTV and such. So when all the kids were talking about, like, Beavis and Butthead, I couldn't talk about it because I was not allowed to watch it. So it wasn't until I started hearing people talk about video games, I just, you know, scooched myself right in there and just became part of the conversation. And because of that, I've made a lot more friends and such, a lot more than probably I made in the first grade and second grade and third grade. Granted, I did have my friends, but not as many until I started playing like more hardcore games like Sonic the Hedgehog and all like the 16-bit system titles. From my current gameplay experience, like I tend to put like the role-playing games like Final Fantasy and Chrono Cross. I actually put those more on the bottom of my must playlist, which is weird, considering that what you said, the studies show that most people with autism are drawn more towards that specific genre of games. I mean, what do you think it is about RPGs that can be seen as helpful for those, not just for you, not just for you in general, but for everybody with autism?
I mean, if I had to give my opinion on that, I would say that maybe it's just the emotional investment and the control that you can have over everything. Because I know the people that I have met, they talk about, you know, they don't have a lot of control over things. They don't understand social situations. I know that I don't. I'm far too often I've had somebody tell me a joke and I take it completely literally and then like it ruins it. But yeah, it could be that it's that ability to control what you're doing and controlling the outcome and feeling like you have a sense of belonging and understanding of what is going on. That would be my best opinion and guess on it.
I would also think, too, that maybe with RPGs, there's also the choice of and consequence of some of the choices that you make.
Yes.
And you would put that, you would basically make the choices that, not that your character would do, but what you yourself would do, and if you were put in that same situation.
Yeah, I remember the first game that I played that had choice and consequences would have been Fable. I believe it was Fable 2. I didn't really get into Fable 1, but Fable 2 introduced that whole hero, devil, back and forth thing, like where you do good and you become an angel, and you do bad and you become this really creepy looking thing. And so yeah, that was the first game that I had played that, you know, there were really a lot of consequences that I started to notice that, okay, if I do this, this is going to happen. And that really made me start thinking about, you know, if I do this in my life, you know, what are the consequences that are going to happen for that? So that was actually the start of where I started seeing and thinking more, you know, long-term and repercussions. That helps.
And I totally agree with you on that, but out of curiosity, too, do you think there are other genres of video games that help out in similar situations like the RPGs do?
Yeah, I really don't know. I wish I had an answer for that. But I guess I can only go off of what I've experienced. Sorry.
It's okay. Don't worry. So there were a couple parts of the article that you wrote that spoke to me the most. And the first part was, it was you dealing with meeting others with your disability. And it was about how you've met with others with autism, and you had some reservations about them. Like, when you were first meeting others with your disability, like, what was going through your head?
All right, confession time. Okay.
Go ahead.
I was nasty. Like, I wasn't outwardly nasty, but my thoughts were really vicious, and I kept telling myself, you know, I can't be autistic because I had viewed autistic people in a very negative light, unfortunately. Like, I thought that autistic people were more on the severe side of the spectrum in every case. I didn't think that there was a mild or, you know, not mild or any kind of real spectrum to it. I thought it was very just severe in every case. So
yes.
I was thinking, you know, well, I can't be like that because I don't do what, you know, I don't do that muscle spasm thing. You know, I don't rock that hard, you know. Okay, yeah, okay, I might do that with my hands, but I don't do that all the time. And yeah, I just had really nasty thoughts, and I was just like, I can't be them because I don't do that. And I was really judgmental, and I'm really not proud of myself, but I started getting out of myself a little bit, and I was like, okay, well, let me just talk to them. Let me just get to know them. And a lot of the time, like, how do I word this? Sorry, my words are not coming.
Go on, it's okay. Don't worry. Speak from the heart. Speak from the mind. Speak with the gut. Have all three parts of those bodies and just come together and say what is truthful in your opinion.
I did not expect autistic people, in the even the most severe cases, to be as incredibly intelligent and insightful as they really are. And people don't take the time, I feel, I know I didn't take the time at first, to sit down and really talk to them and get to know them. And she just, when you don't understand what you don't know and you don't take the time to understand it, I mean, you're hesitant about it and you make really quick, mean judgments. But my husband, fortunately, was like, well, you need to go talk to them because you're never going to know unless you talk to them. You're never going to know unless you ask. So I sat down with this really adorable little girl. She was like 11 years old. I don't remember her name, but I was at my geneticist's office. And she was sitting there playing with toys, and I was like, ah, so you're here for autism too? And I was just really blunt. She's like, yeah. I was like, I'll be honest, I don't know anything about being autistic, but my doctor says I am. And she's like, oh, that's fine. And so we started talking in the short amount of time that we had, and she was just telling me, you know, like about her experience. And, you know, I don't remember what she had, but she said that people are going to judge you no matter what you want them to know. And the only thing that you can really do is just know who you are and accept who you are, because that's going to take you really, really far in your life with your battle with autism.
Mm, and I totally agree. And great. And I too have had like these reservations in the past, and you know, I won't lie, you know, once in a while, like one of those reservations will return. But you know, as a kid, I used to go to special groups and such, you know, during middle school and high school. And actually, this is a bit of a scary story, but there was one time where I went to one of these autism meetings, and I was playing Pokemon in the corner of a room, just minding my own business. And this kid, who was also autistic, and I think he was like a lot lower functioning, he was playing around with a bowling pin. He's like whirling it around and such. Uh-huh. And he ran up to me and smacked me in the head with it. And I had stitches put in.
Oh, ouch. Did you ever recover? Do you still have a scar? Do you show people that scar? You're like, hey, look at this scar. Check
it out. I have a tiny little bit of a scar, which is why I would never want to shave my head, because it's a little bit noticeable. But it was a moment that really frightened me away from being with other autistic people, because I was afraid something like that was going to happen again. And it wasn't until, I want to say maybe college, when I started going back to a couple meetings, and the people I was surrounded with, they were okay, but again, I had those sort of reservations about who I was with, because I thought, like, I was being surrounded by other people who were high-functioning autistic, like I was, and according to, you know, to what I was told, I was, but there are still levels of high-functioning autism within the same way of regular and low-functioning. Like, if you were to go with, like, Dungeons and Dragons terms, like, there's the low-functioning, regular-functioning, and high-functioning, and that's a three-sided dice. But then within that segment of each of those three sides of the dice is another 20-sided dice. For each of those segments. So there'd be 20 versions of the low-functioning, 20 versions of the regular-functioning, and then 20 versions of the high functioning. And I'm just using that as an example. There's probably a lot of versions of this. It's different from person to person.
Yeah, it really is. Everybody's different. But I mean, even if you're autistic or not, I mean, everybody is different. So
yeah.
What's wrong with people with autism being different than what people perceive them to be?
Right. And, you know, no, I won't lie. I don't go to meetings anymore and stuff like that. I mean, I have a couple of friends who are autistic and are of the Asperger syndrome. You know, once in a great while I'll hang out with them and such, but it's still sometimes really hard for me to actually go to like an event with other people with autism and Asperger's, because it's sort of, I still kind of feel uncomfortable about being surrounded by others. Like, Like, I know this is going to sound a little bit, I don't want to sound mean and cruel, but, like, this is kind of hard because, like, I find that when I'm around too many people who are of the autistic spectrum, I feel my sensitivity, like, cranked up. I feel like my hearing and my sense of touch becomes too sensitive that sometimes, like, I don't want to say it physically hurts to be around other people with autism, but it sometimes feels like that, and I feel really guilty that this happens to me.
Well, what do you think it could be, if you don't mind me asking?
That's the thing. I don't know if it's because of too much self-awareness, or if it's something that, you know, that's happens to some other autistic people, that if they're around others that are with the same spectrum, that they feel a sort of like multiplied sensitivity. I mean, I don't know if there's anything that's written in books about this sort of thing, or I don't know. Like, it's weird because I never had this problem as a kid when I was going to the May Center, not knowing that I was being surrounded by autistic kids. So it could be more of a mental thing. And that's something that I'm still working on as a person who is high-functioning autistic. I've made great strides. I've made friends who are autistic. But in terms of going to events and such, like going to things, to like panels and conferences and such, like I'm still very hesitant to do stuff like that, but it's with enough of a push, I do it. Like, I did go to like this one panel thing about autism, and yeah, this is going to sound weird, autism and sexuality, about people with autism who are still struggling with trying to, you know, try to find a girlfriend, trying to find, or in some cases, trying to find a boyfriend. And, you know, I went to this, I tried to have an open mind about it, and what the guy was talking about was basically the same shit I heard in sex education.
Okay.
So I went to this 2-hour seminar basically for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's reasons why I get so hesitant about some of this stuff too, because like a lot of the events that I've gone to in the past, whether it's something like that or for like doing a job search sort of thing, what these people are teaching the other people with autism, I had already learned.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is still a bit of a hesitation on my part. It's something that I am still working on. And, you know, I know that I'm going to be able to overcome it someday in some shape or form. But, you know, I've just been really busy with the website, the podcast show, and reviewing games and everything that I don't even really have time to go to any of these events.
Hmm. So out of all these events you've gone to, I'm curious, have you gone to one that you actually did take anything away from? I mean, obviously you take something away from everything you go to, but was there particularly one panel that really, you know, struck a chord with you? Was it just this one on sex education, or
no? That's the thing. Like, I'm trying to really think back at every single event I've gone to. You know, I've only been to probably like 10 or 12 in my entire life, and there's really nothing that I could think of that was like, wow, I learned something today.
Hmm.
You know, everything that I've been to, whether it's something like a job search and job etiquette, and like one of these job search etiquette things that I went to it wasn't just for people with autism, it was other people with disabilities and such. And, you know, I tried to listen to what the people were saying, but I had the unfortunate happening of sitting next to somebody who, during the entire seminar, thought it would be a good idea to start drawing people in, let's just say, triple X rated positions.
Compromising positions.
Compromising, thank you.
Got it.
So this person was doing that next to me, and I'm like, I can't listen to it anymore because I'm creeped the fuck out by the person that's right next to me doing this.
Oh, maybe that's the equivalent of somebody behind you shooting a spitball at you. I don't know. Everybody has their own way of dealing with those situations, right?
Yeah.
But I get it. That would have made me really uncomfortable. I would have been like, you know, that's not actually how it looks. Maybe you do this, you gotta change that. let's talk about the shape of that, because that's like Barbie. That's not proportionally right. Hold on, wait.
I think the testicles go below, not above the penis.
Okay.
I know, that went a little bit of an awkward part of the show. I'm sorry.
All right, so turning back around.
All right, so one other part that I found intriguing, too, was about, well, you met your husband online, and he was stationed out in Japan. And you talked about your first visit over there. And what I found interesting about it was, like, I myself visited Japan, and it was during this trip where I, like, in a sense, it's kind of weird saying, I felt myself being cured of, like, of all the final issues I had with autism. Like, when you were, it was because of the people I was talking to and the atmosphere I was in, I felt like it was, like, an environmental cure for what I was dealing with. And I'm curious if like, there was a similar effect to you when you visited Japan for the first time.
Japan was amazing. Let me just put that out there. If I could live anywhere, I would live in Japan.
Me too.
if you don't mind me asking really quick, where in Japan did you visit?
So my best friend lives in Katsukobe, so I stayed with him and his family. So I was around there in Tokyo. I visited the John Lennon Museum, where I had that sort of, right after I went to the John Lennon Museum with my friend's sister, is where I started to have that sort of epiphany and that feeling of being cured. But I also went to, like, Nikko and checked out the hot springs down there, and even took part in a Shinto ceremony down in their, in those really old shrines they have down there.
I love the shrines. I miss the shrines. So I was in northern Japan. I was probably about 10 hours north of Tokyo at Misawa Air Base, which is where Eric was stationed at the time. And
so was it like right near Hokkaido and that vicinity?
It's like Hachinohe area. If you're familiar with Hachinohe?
A little bit.
Truthfully, I don't really remember the names of the places. I never quite grasped onto the geology. That is not my forte at all. There were a lot of mountains and a lot of rice fields. but anyways, so I wish I could show you a picture of what I was like several years ago, because if you knew me, like, even 5 years ago, I really hated change. I could not tolerate change at all. If something changed in my life, I was, you know, a kid throwing over a temper tantrum over not having a donut, I guess would be the equivalent. Like, I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it now, and if I didn't get it. And so change was really hard for me, and I was in a really bad place at the time when I met my husband, mentally really, really, really bad. He was probably the first person in my life that was really just completely blunt with me. And I'd been used to kind of being babied a little bit because I was I was different. I responded differently than kids around me, and I acted differently than, I guess, what was expected of me. So I got babied a little bit, and he made me feel like an adult. Like I needed to get myself straight, and he would. So I took a risk, and it was the biggest change I ever made in my life was leaving where I was and flying to the other side of the world to meet a person that I had never met before in my entire life. And from the moment I stepped off the plane, I felt different. I really did. So I don't know if it was, you know, because it was in Japan, or if it was because I was doing something that I never, ever thought that I was going to do. And that was a real big starting change in my life. I I had somebody that was, you know, like pushing me. I would say that I can't, and he'd be like, well, you're gonna. And I would say, I don't want to. And he's like, well, you don't have a choice. You're gonna. And I started socializing. I started talking to people. Even when I couldn't find the words to say whatever it was I was trying to say, he would help me through it. And to have somebody that patient and willing to work with me, it was incredible. And maybe it was a combination of him and, you know, Japan that makes that whole period fun for me.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you guys been together? Like, how strong has your relationship been going for?
Well, we've been married 3.5 years. We were dating. I use air quotes. You can't see them, but I'm using air quotes. Dating for like 4 months. We were together 4 months, and he popped the question, and I was like, okay. but we knew each other over the internet for the better part of 2.5 years. And I don't want to say that I was changing, but he was, you know, he was listening to me, and I was working through a lot of things going on in my head, trying to sort out a lot of my thoughts. I don't think people really realize how much of a mess it is in a person's head. Sometimes, like, my head is always a mess. Like, I have trouble focusing on what I'm thinking. I don't even know the equivalent. I think in my article I said that sometimes it feels like my thoughts are going at the speed of Sonic the Hedgehog and my mouth is moving at the speed of Tails. Like, and I mean that as in, like, just automatic, it happens. Like, there's no second there to, like, process it out. But, and to have, you know, he really helps me with that. He's incredible. We've been together 3.5 years, married. Mm-hmm. I totally went way far beyond your question. Sorry.
No. Don't worry. Let me just say, you give a lot of people, you know, hearing something like that, you're giving a lot of people with autism hope that they're going to be able to find, you know, the right person in their life as well, too.
You know, I honestly thought that I would never find anybody because, I mean, I had relationships, and I'll be the first person to admit that I am a very difficult person to be with. The only difference between then and now is that I can tell you why I'm difficult to be with. But I think the key to being with anybody is being willing to work through the difficult times and understanding and communicating. And that was actually a question that I had received in response to my article. And somebody was like, well, you're autistic. Autistic people don't have sex. And I was like, yeah, we do. I do. And it's just like, how could you not think that I wouldn't have sex just because I'm autistic? Like, I have needs just like you and, you know, the people next to you.
Everybody loves sex.
Who doesn't? But, yeah, like, and somebody else had asked me, they didn't ask me, they stated, they're like, well, autistic people, they don't get married and have jobs. And it's like, well, who told you that? Because whoever told you that was dead wrong, because I'm married and I have a job and I'm autistic. So,
so just like, fuck you.
Yeah, well, I didn't say that, but.
But I bet guess, you thought it, though. I bet you.
I did, yeah, I kind of did, just a little bit.
So, if you don't mind me asking, like, what, because you write for Nerdy But Flirty, and what got you into writing about video games, and who pushed you to do stuff like that?
Okay, so this will go back probably about a couple of years. I was just starting to come out of the I'm proud to be a girl that plays video games closet. Like, I didn't know that there was such a thing as a girl gamer or a girl geek, and,
Hey, it's now half and half. 50% gamers are girls, 50% gamers are boys.
Yeah. So, my husband took me to L.A. We went to L.A. to go see a movie that was coming out about the game that I was obsessed with at the time, which was Dragon Age Origins, with Alistair. I don't know if there's any Alistair fans, if you're an Alistair or Dragon Age fan, but I loved Dragon Age. Like, I could not put it down. And my husband was like, oh, well, they're coming out with a movie about it. Let's go to LA to see it. I was like, no, let's not. He's like, let's go to LA to see it. And so we finally did. And there was a girl there that I met. She was sitting next to us, and her name was Sarah. I started talking to her, and she was making me laugh, and she was telling me about her website, and she was there to review the movie, and we ended up connecting, and I went home, and I looked her up, and I found her, and I stalked her, and I friended her, and I was reading her website, and she was the first girl that I had met who was, you know, like, big, I guess, in a sense, on gaming, and she was okay with it, and she was proud of it, and I thought that was really cool, because I don't have a lot of experience with girls who play video games. Like, in my experience, it's always been guys who have been gung-ho for video games and gaming. And I took the time to get to know her a little bit, and then I somehow ended up writing for her. I don't know if I asked her if I could write or try writing, or if she came to me. I truthfully can't remember. But she's been incredibly patient with me learning how to find my words and work through writing and really developing where I come from as a gamer. I'm sorry, that's my phone. I should probably turn it off. The minion from Despicable Me.
Oh, yeah, I recognize the laugh.
But, so yeah, Sarah's incredibly patient, and I wouldn't have been able to publish this article without her at all, so...
Yeah, and I'm really glad that Otaku Gamer 5000 also brought it to my attention, and it brought a really big smile to my face, that whole thing about you and yourself, so...
Oh, thank you.
I'm glad that you guys were able to showcase that. So, like, for me, like, I started out doing a radio show back at Salem State College in 2006, and... before then, I became friends with a bunch of people at Salem State's Anime Club, and one of them was Pandalicious from Electric Sisterhood. And it wasn't until, like, late 2007, they had just started getting the ball rolling on the Electric Sisterhood website a year before. Actually, around the same time I started doing my radio show at Salem State. And I don't know if it was me or if it was Pandalicious that... came up to me and asked if I wanted to write for a website. And I gave it a shot, and I wound up really enjoying it. And every week ever since, I want to say February 2008, I've had at least one piece published on there. And from there, I was able to start up the Boston Bash Brigade with my friend and co-host of the radio show, Bluonic. And we started trying our best to take the world by storm from there. And
that's really cool.
And it's been great. It's been fantastic. Meeting the people, going to these conventions, rubbing elbows with people at E3, checking out free concerts and post parties, and playing with the giant dildo bat from Saints Row.
What? Sorry, I heard the word dildo. My mind's going really dirty right now.
So I went to the Saints Row party at this past year's E3, and our good friend and PR person for Deep Silver, Aubrey, she had the big purple dildo bat that you use in Saints Row the Third.
Okay.
Oh, I take it you've never played this game before.
I have not. I'm so sorry, but I've got this picture of a dildo bat in my head, and I'm like, I know that's not right. Like, this picture is not right at all.
It's, take something that's about 5 feet in length, giant and purple, with the end of a bat and, well, with the handle of a bat, and just a big, floppy, purple dick.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, all right.
They just came out with a new one, Saints Row 4.
Mm-hmm.
It is great. It's fantastic. Definitely check it out. But it's funny because I mentioned, because I going into this industry, I thought I would never be able to be doing stuff like attending E3, going to parties, doing all this crazy stuff. I never thought that a person in my situation would be going to all these events. And I'm thankful every day for Pandalicious for putting me under her wing to do all this stuff.
Nice. So what's been your favorite convention to go to?
You know, I love PAX East every year. And I feel like probably PAX East 2011 was one of my absolute favorites. That was when I really started coming out of my shell and really started chatting with all the developers, doing impromptu interviews, not preparing beforehand, and doing a lot better with it. But I do have to say that the most fun I've had was this past year's E3. Just the people I got to chat with, going hands-on with the new systems, meeting people from all around the world. I made friends from Bahrain, like places in the Middle East, places I never even thought video games were even being played in. And was just really excited to just meet the people more than actually play the games. Although, yeah. Don't get me wrong, I love playing the games at this thing.
Okay. So, did you, they already had PAX this year, right? But there's another one coming up?
Yeah, PAX Prime in Seattle. That's one I really want to go to, but it's quite costly to be flying to Seattle from Boston, and it's something I hope maybe to do next year, but I just need to really save up my money to do it.
Yeah, I can totally relate on not thinking that you would ever make it to these events, because I just made it to my very first convention, which is actually Comic-Con in San Diego this year. And that was incredibly difficult for me, because I've never done very well in places where there are a lot of people. I tend to have really embarrassing panic attacks and anxiety, and I really clam up, and I just kind of go stiff, and I get stuck in my head, but I made it to the convention this year, and it was my first, and I loved it. Like, I didn't think I was going to love it that much or have that much fun, and it could have been a mix of it being a new thing, and the fact that I was dressed up as Aerith from Final Fantasy VII, but yeah, I have actually been thinking about wanting to go to other conventions, so if I get to that point where I'm feeling brave enough to go to another convention, would PAX be a good one for me to start with?
Absolutely. I would definitely recommend probably PAX East first, because that's a 3-day event, and PAX Prime is it's like a 5-day event, so I don't know if maybe the less days it is, the less stressful it might be for you, or how long was San Diego Comic-Con again?
I think it lasted like 5 days, if I remember correctly.
Oh, the PAX Prime is okay for you then. So, if you, I don't know, that it's probably sold out already, so it might be too late for that, but PAX East is coming up in April in Boston. If you do wind up being able to save up for it, it's something I really recommend doing.
Okay. Very cool. So, is there a person in particular that you've met that you've been kind of like a huge landmark for you of the reality of like how far you feel that you've come?
Well, this isn't a video game based one. This is more because I also interview bands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite punk rock bands, I got to interview the lead singer, Damian Abraham, who sometimes goes by the name of Pink Eyes. And I've met him before. He's super nice. And it's crazy because he's like this screamo punk rocker, fronts a band called Fucked Up.
Okay.
And they just released this album called David Comes to Life, and it's a rock opera, or a punk rock opera, or punkra, if you want to call it. And at the time, it was starting to get, you know, big and popular, and, well, not big and popular, it was starting to get, like, critically acclaimed by so many people, as the previous albums were. And I got to interview Damian, like, I want to say a week or two after that album had released. And I was like one of the first people to really sit down and actually talk about the album with him and everything else that was connected to David Comes to Life, because it was a huge project. I mean, there were vinyl singles, like 7-inch vinyl singles about the characters specifically from in David Comes to Life. And there was like an album that they had made of like, where they posed as 11 different bands that lived within this, like, fictional British city that takes place in David Comes to Life. So this was a massive project that they had done for this one album. And for me to really be sitting down and just him just talking about it with stride and relaxation, it was the best interview I'd ever done in my life. But, you know, it wasn't, like, the biggest person I interviewed, but he was one of the most important people that I got to chat with, mainly because one of the other awesome things, too, was, like, at the end of the year, that album was named, like, Album of the Year by, like, Spin Magazine and, like, a bunch of other magazines as well. So they became very noticeable by the media and to the public because of that.
Nice. Very nice. Congratulations on your interview. That's really cool.
Thank you. And, you know, since then, I've done other interviews with bands. I've interviewed... have you ever heard of Jonathan Colton?
I have. Oh, my gosh. I first came to know him when I was playing Portal. I cannot play Portal, by the way, but I love the game. Because every time I play it, I feel like I have to run to the bathroom because I think that I'm going to be so sick. I have really bad vertigo. So, like, falling through all the portal holes, like, for the... No, it just doesn't settle. But I will... I won't face the screen, but I will sit there and I will listen. And I remember at the very end of the first one when the song came on, Still Alive with Gladys, that was when I became familiar with who Jonathan Colton is. I love him. Love him. Did I mention that I really love him?
Yes, yes. How about a year before, I got to interview Paul and Storm, who are buddies of Jonathan Colton. They usually tour with them. And then... this past year, I got to interview MC Frontalot.
Okay.
And who I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's a really awesome nerdcore rapper. He actually does a song called You've Got Asperger's.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to... Can you hum a few bars for me? I'd love to hear this.
I can't off the top of my head, but if you look up the lyrics, it's actually a pretty funny song.
I am writing that down. I have to look that up. You have Asperger's. Got it.
So maybe this will lead towards my next question, because you know how, you know, autism has been portrayed in the media, in like movies and TV shows and such, and for the majority of the time, they tend to focus more on the, like, not just the low functioning autism, but like basically the worst case scenario, low functioning of autism.
Yeah.
Do you feel like maybe, why do you think that they keep portraying it like this?
Because it's TV or film? I'm not sure. I really don't know. Maybe it's they want people to have a connection with something, and people, they tend to develop more of a connection with something that makes them feel emotional. So obviously if you give the more severe side of something that people already feel is a misfortune, I guess that would draw them in.
Right. And, you know, this is something I've had an issue with for years, because, like, you would think that there would be more of an equal opportunity to showcase both the, you know, low-functioning, regular-functioning, and the high-functioning. But, you know, to equally show it, like, 33% low-functioning, 34% regular functioning, 33% high functioning. But in reality, when you look at Hollywood and when they portray it in the media and all that, it's like 99.9% of it is extremely low functioning.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it gives a lot of negative light on people who do have high functioning autism. It makes it really difficult for us to, you know, get... what's the word I'm looking for?
Out there.
Yes! Thank you. I'll go with that. It's like, that goes back to, you know, my trouble with accepting it when I was talking about how I was stacking myself up against other people with autism, and I was, you know, putting myself out there to get to know people with autism. And I would have to say definitely that the media in that light, with showing usually only the extreme cases of it, really made me feel like, well, that's a whole other reason why I can't be autistic. It's because I'm not like that. I don't function like that. I don't act like, okay, maybe I act like that a little, but I don't act like that. And unfortunately, it's just, I don't even know what to say about that. I could go on about that for a long time.
Trust me, I have a punch with Dustin Hoffman's name on it because of the whole Rain Man thing.
I actually didn't see that. I didn't watch a lot of movies growing up. I tended to hide in my room, and just, if I wasn't hiding in my room, I was playing a game, so I didn't watch a lot of movies. I am catching up on it, though, and that's on my list.
Okay. Just fair warning, it's another extremely low functioning as usual type of film. And one of the things that troubles me too is like they would hope, like celebrities are hosting benefits about autism. One specifically that comes to mind is like the Night of Too Many Stars that Jon Stewart does every year. And one of the things that bothers me, like don't get me wrong, like I'm happy that they're getting it out there. But the thing is, after the comedy bits, they would then show a commercial about autism and everything. And it's, again, it's always the low spectrum that they're showing. They're showing, like, the worst-case scenario in these commercials and PSAs. But they never really touch on the high-functioning and the regular functioning like they should.
Okay, so you're an aspiring filmmaker. If you were in that position, what would you do about that? If you don't mind me asking.
Well, as someone that, you know, is interested in filmmaking and stuff, and I was given the situation, I would try to do an autistic character that's as badass as possible. Like maybe someone that's, I know it's a little bit stereotypical of someone good with numbers, but like a really cool hacker, like in a not, like, sort of like a lull sacker and an anonymous type of styled hacker who can, like, just, like, outsmart just about any of the cops and police and stuff. Make him a bit of a bad guy that you can root for.
Okay, I guess I could see myself getting on that. But would you be worried about how people also, because I know that this is another stereotype that people have that I've had asked to me before is, so you're autistic, so that must mean you're really good with computers and numbers. I mean, what would you say to that? Like, if you put that out there about having a bad guy that is just like that and ahead of the cops in that manner, would you be worried about putting out another stereotype out there?
And That is true, and let me just say I sucked at math from high school through college.
So you and me both.
my tutor took pity on me. That's how bad I was at it.
Oh, that is pretty bad, actually. I'm kidding.
No, don't be. But I can, maybe not someone that's good at computers, make them like a secret agent spy or something. But the thing is, like, with me from my personal experience with, like, guns and such, because, you know, I've gone to the shooting range a couple times, I have to have, like, double the amount of, like, ear protection because of the sensitivity to the hearing that I have for loud noises that is not music. Like if it's music, loud concerts, I'm cool. But if it's, like, pyrotechnics or fireworks, I can't enjoy myself.
Aw, I'm sorry.
It's okay. So I would have to think of something along the lines of, like, a badass secret agent spy who has sort of, like a partner who comes in handy, like, will toss him, like, the ear, like, his, like, ear protection. He puts it on, like, in a split second, pulls out both of his, like, Desert Eagles and starts firing away at, like, like the evil Russian spies or something like that.
Okay.
Something like that. I mean, I'm just going off the top of my head for something like that. So.
No, it's just great. I'm having a really good laugh over here.
Well, thank you.
I mean that in a flattering way, by the way.
Thank you. Well, that might also bring me to a little bit of the thing that I do complain about as well. And I do need to explain about this one is like, like, I know that there are a lot of stand-up comics out there that may, you know, they may talk about autism and they may joke about autism and their bits. And I don't get mad at that because if you're a stand-up comedian, everything is fair game, in my honest opinion. I do not believe in political correctness when it comes to a lot of this stuff. If you can't make fun of one thing, and then who's to say someone's going to come out of the woodwork and say, hey, you can't make fun of that either, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth, to the point where you can't make fun of anything, ergo, you have no material.
Yeah.
So, what I complain about is, like, I know it sounds mean, but some people who whine about comics making fun of autism because they know someone with autism, but it's more of in the sense of, like, they didn't really read into what the comic was talking about and just automatically assumed that he was, like, making fun of autism in general, when it's more about we should laugh about our disabilities, because when we laugh about them, that's when we win.
Yeah, and definitely. You feel better about it. You feel better about yourself. You know, it doesn't seem so terrible when you can laugh about it. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's something that I truly believe that, like, laughter is one of the best sources of medicine out there. It's what really helped me get out of my shell a lot more, too. Not just video games, but when I was a kid, I would be watching, like, the Benny Hill Show and Monty Python with my grandpa. And it was during a time when I was still learning how to laugh and smile and everything, and that all I would have to do was just hang out with my grandpa, and that would help me out more than anything that speech or occupational therapy could ever do.
Yeah. So which Monty Python?
All of it. Like, I watched, like, Holy Grail, Life of Brian, Meaning of Life, Life at Hollywood Bowl, Flying Circus, Now for Something Completely Different. I played the video games as a kid. I loved Monty Python's Complete Waste of Time. That was such a funny video game as a kid.
I just recently got on the Monty Python bandwagon, so I'm a little behind on it, but the important part is that I'm getting there. But I love Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail. And they brought that game into a card game. I don't know if you've ever played Flex, but
yes, I've heard about that.
It's awesome. I highly recommend that you sit down and play it, because I learned about the nudge, nudge, wink, wink. What do you mean? What do you mean? Monty Python. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I actually got and saw, you know how they turned into a musical too, Spamalot. I saw it opening week on Broadway with David Hyde Pierce, Hank Azaria, all of the original cast were there. In there. So it was really cool seeing that. And what's awesome too is my mom's boss a couple months later went, because she had a friend who was dating someone. I think he was dating one of the actors from Spamalot. And thanks to her, I have autographs on my wall from David Hyde Pierce, Hank Azaria, and the friend actor, Christopher Sieber.
Hi.
So that was really cool that she did that for me.
That's nice.
But yeah, Monty Python played a huge role into opening me up into, like, expressing myself just a little bit more. Like, I would use, like, in the fifth grade, I would recite the Bring Out Your Dead scene. Word for word.
Yeah, I love that scene. It's like, bring out your dead. Oh my gosh. I do that so often. I'll just, like, be standing somewhere and I'll quote something. And, like, when we play that game and they tell you to, like, reenact the scene or something, like, I always do that scene. It's probably well, like, I don't even do it very well, but it's fun.
Really cool. It's so... Maybe the last question I have for you is, like, what sort of advice could you give to both parents and those with the disability on, like, how to conquer autism? What is the best sort of advice you could give to them?
To the parents or to the children of autism?
Everyone. Well, everyone in general, basically.
Well, it sucks. Having that label, you kind of learn to live with it, but... people are going to say a lot of things, and they're going to treat you in ways that you don't understand why they're treating you that way or how they could possibly have that opinion of you. And there are going to be days when you think that's it. That's the end of everything. And you can't deal with it anymore. And the best advice that I could give anybody is just smile. Just remember that being autistic doesn't mean that you're stupid or incapable or different in a bad way. It doesn't mean anything other than you're autistic and you see the world and experience the world a little differently, and you shouldn't be ashamed of that. You should never, ever be ashamed of being autistic.
Jessica, thank you so much for coming on to Boston Bastion Brigade to talk about this. The article is called Autism, Gaming, and Me.
Yeah.
How Video Games Helped. You can find it on nerdybutflirty.com, as well as Jessica Crosby's other works. Jessica, thank you again. And hopefully one day soon, you and I could meet up, maybe next year's PAX East, and have a beer together.
That would be great.
Thank you. A very special thanks to Andre Tipton, a.k.a. Otaku Gamer 5000, of Real Otaku Gamer, for introducing the both of us. This was a great chat that I had with her, and I hope all of you learned a little something new from this discussion. So, thanks again for tuning into this special podcast show. Remember, visit our website at b3crew.com for recent news, reviews, podcast episodes, and videos featuring members of the Boston Bash Brigade. Follow me on Twitter at king_baby_duck. Write to us at thebastards@bostonbashbrigade.com. Like us on Facebook on facebook.com/bostonbashbrigade. And follow us on Tumblr at b3crew.tumblr.com. And until next time, this is King Baby Duck, reminding you, you don't have to be from Boston to be a bastard, but it sure helps.